I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Rabbi Jonah Pesner, the director of the Religious Action Center of Reform Judaism and senior vice president of the Union for Reform Judaism. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our two Jewish Mavenah on Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our Maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. I did something a little different last weekend, riding my bicycle in the Tour de Tucson race, all 106 miles. It was great fun and really gratifying that my wife Wendy put it up on Facebook, and I received an avalanche of good wishes and congratulations after the fact. Being Jewish, most of the texts and comments I got beforehand were along the lines of, "Be careful, Rabbi. Don't get hurt. Be safe. Don't fall." And of course, "Don't get any flat tires." Actually, everything about the ride went beautifully, and my primary feelings now are of gratitude and thanksgiving, entirely appropriate for this time of year. It's the Sunday after Thanksgiving, the principal holiday of overeating in American tradition, what we would call fressing in Yiddish. It's a good thing that this year, at least, Hanukkah is still 4 weeks away, which gives us a little time to lose the weight we gained before we start powering down all those latkes. By the way, our own greatest Hanukkah on Earth 18 celebration, Shine All Night, will take place at Temple Emmanuel on Sunday, December 11th. 2 weeks from today, a pre-holiday show of world-class music excellence, free to everyone, open to the community at 4:30 p.m. Call 520-327-4501 for more information or go to tetucson.org. Anyway, while I assume that more than a few of you are headed for shopping dates at the mall today, it's worth noting that the real purpose of the weekend is to give thanks to God for all that we already have, not what we are about to purchase. The whole process of giving thanks is interesting. We all have a lot to give thanks for, of course, but we usually get in the habit of taking those things we should feel most grateful for granted. In truth, if we have enough to eat, and this weekend, boy, did we have enough to eat, and if we have clothes to wear, a place to sleep, we should feel pretty good about things. If we are also blessed with health, family, friends, we have enough to truly celebrate. So let's give thanks, offer a prayer or two to God for the many good things in our lives, and enjoy the end of this holiday weekend together here on Two Jewish. To play us in on this fine morning, here's a little pre-Hanukkah music from our vast store of tunes for the coming Festival of Lights. It begins December 24th. Here's one of Woody Guthrie's fairly recently rediscovered Hanukkah tunes. It's called Hanukkah Dance, recorded by the Klezmatics.
Tiptoe, happy Hanukkah, round you go. My little latke on your toes. Happy Hanukkah, and around you go. Clap your hands, happy Hanukkah, clap, clap hands. My little strudeler on your toes. Happy Hanukkah, and around you go. Jump.
That was the great American folk singer Woody Guthrie's song Hanukkah Dance, as recorded by the wonderful group The Klezmatics. The origin story of these songs of Woody Guthrie's, well, it's fascinating. His second wife, Marjorie, the mother of four of his children, including Arlo Guthrie of Alice's Restaurant fame, was Jewish, as were those kids. They lived on Mermaid Avenue in Brooklyn. And along with his many working-class ballads, protest songs, and love songs, Woody Guthrie penned a whole cycle of Hanukkah songs. These, along with a huge collection of other tunes, remained unrecorded in Brooklyn until Woody's granddaughter Nora contacted one of the top klezmer groups in the world, the Klezmatics, and they collaborated on a CD that was released in time for Hanukkah, oh, almost 10 years ago, called Happy Joyous Hanukkah. Well, it's coming for everyone. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish, Rabbi Jonah Pesner, is the director of the Religious Action Center in Washington, D.C., the arm of the reform movement that works for social justice in the halls of Congress and the White House. Find out how Rabbi Pesner and the RAC intend to work with a very different kind of administration in the coming year when we return in just a moment here on Too Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays I do yoga. Wednesdays we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursday is my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
We are delighted to welcome to Jewish our guest this morning. Rabbi Jonah Pesner is head of the Religious Action Center of Reform Judaism, one of the central institutions and one of the most important organizations working for social justice in this country. He has led the RAC since 2015. He also serves as a senior vice president of Union for Reform Judaism, the organization of the Reform Movement. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
So it's a huge transition to have replaced Rabbi David Saperstein, the nearly legendary head of the RAC. How do you feel like it's going?
Oh, you're so kind to ask and to acknowledge David. He's been a mentor and an inspiration for me for 30 years. David, one of his brilliant successes that people don't really give him enough credit for, beyond all the legislation that he helped craft and the bipartisan majorities that he helped wrangle to pass civil rights legislation throughout his career, was bringing teenagers to Washington to learn Jewish social justice and civic engagement. And he had that idea back in 1983, and he turned to some rabbinic colleagues of his and asked them if they wanted to pilot this idea of bringing teenagers to Washington. And I was actually the youth group president of a synagogue in New York City at the time, and my student rabbi asked me if I wanted to do this, and I did. So it was really a profound, life-changing experience to meet David, to come to Washington, to study Jewish sources, and then to go up on Capitol Hill and really advocate for the enduring Jewish values of our tradition. David's been a mentor and a friend since then, and, you know, I think it's going pretty well, but I guess you'd have to ask him.
Well, you know, he was a world ambassador now, so it's hard to do that. And by the way, I should note a good friend of Too Jewish has been on several times. I remember talking to Rabbi Saperstein years ago in the midst of the Reagan-Bush years and saying, well, how does the RAC operate in an environment in which it seems like the administration and the Congress even are not on the same page? We're about to be in that circumstance now. How would you respond?
You know, it's a very complicated landscape, and I want to acknowledge about David and what he taught me, that he also really worked very hard to create and cultivate relationships on both sides of the aisle and find areas of compromise and commonality, letting religious traditions and values rise above partisan bickering and differences. So during the Bush years, he worked very hard on issues around global AIDS, human trafficking, international religious freedom. That actually led to the ambassadorship that he leads now. And when he was confirmed by the Senate, by the way, he was confirmed in an overwhelming vote, which was bipartisan, with, you know, senators with names like Rubio and Cruz, in addition to senators like Feinstein and Schumer. So he really has taught me how you kind of find common ground and compromise. We're, of course, in a bit of an uncharted moment in American history, because right now I don't think the challenge is so much about partisanship and finding areas of compromise. I think right now we're in the wake of an election that gave rise and voice to so much bigotry, whether it's anti-Semitism that now has surfaced. We've, you know, seen the study by the Anti-Defamation League, which reported billions and billions of impressions of anti-Semitic tweets and posts or the anti-Muslim rhetoric and bigotry, or this discussion of registering Muslims. And we've heard stories of women having their hijabs pulled from their heads, and of course, you know, the misogyny and the racism. So I think the urgent question of the day is, how will the faith community move all elected officials into a place of defending the rights of all minorities and de-escalating the violent rhetoric of hate that we've really heard all over the internet? And that should be really troubling to any minority. And Jews know uniquely in history what the danger is when there is the tolerance for this kind of hatred.
We will continue this conversation with Rabbi Jonah Pesner, the head of the Religious Action Center in Washington, D.C., and explore the issue of immigration when we return in just a moment here on Too Jewish. We welcome our friends David and Pamela from Freedom Smoke. Good morning.
Hey,
good morning.
Rabbi.
Quitting smoking, big part of your lives.
Yeah, it's very important. When we started this company just over 6 years ago, it was because I had a really bad cigar habit, and it was time for me to quit. We have 7 children. Our youngest just turned 8, and I wish to be around to watch them all grow up and have successful careers and family of their own.
And Pamela, it's better personally, isn't it?
Yeah, most definitely. I'm a non-smoker, and being with a person who smokes cigars in particular, it's much nicer. His body doesn't reek of it, his hair does not reek of it, his clothes do not smell of it, and there's no tobacco between his teeth anymore.
And you don't have to send them for extra showers or
no,
out in the rain.
No extra showers.
How can people find out more about Freedom Smoke?
You can look us up on our website at freedomsmokeusa.com or call us on our toll-free number, 1-800-705-7013. That's 800-705-7013.
Thanks so much.
Thanks,
Thank
Rabbi.
You.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or akvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com, TOOJewishRadio18, or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or download us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Tom, we've been exploring the question of classified information, and we got to the point last week in your long history as a diplomat. You talked about confidential information, which was something that would be of interest to the U.S. government, but maybe wasn't super secret, but had reason to be tightly controlled. Then there's categories of secret and top secret.
Right. These are categories that not only apply to documents, but also refer to the levels of clearance that a person has. Pretty much anybody who works for an embassy and has access to any documents at all needs to have at least a secret clearance. And the background investigation to get a secret clearance takes months and costs thousands of dollars. Then if you are a full-fledged Foreign Service officer and have access to the vast majority of information that's floating around in an embassy, you need a top secret clearance. Again, in the land of acronyms, often shortened to a TS clearance.
As Which has to other a, implications,
as
by
opposed
the way.
To a BS clearance.
Oh, right? I see. Wow.
Okay. So for top secret, it's a longer review process, a longer investigation, much more expensive. So not every employee gets a top secret clearance. Then there are actually levels beyond that that I am not really at liberty to go into. But, you know, top secret is like getting your BA. You're finished with college, you're a graduate. But then there are lots of other degrees you can get.
So there's
beyond
like masters and PhD.
Right.
And
okay. So there are things beyond top secret, but there are also categories that you can put on a document that don't have anything to do with its classification per se, but with how widely or narrowly it's distributed. So there are markings you can put on a piece of paper or a telegram, which means that when it comes into an embassy, only the ambassador and his or her number two will be able to see it routinely. Obviously, they may choose to share it with someone else if they deem that necessary. And I remember when the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan in 1979 and I was posted in Belgrade. I was the embassy duty officer. The Marine security guard called me in at like 2 a.m., said, there's this cable with all these special markings in a sealed envelope. You're supposed to call the ambassador. And I knew that I wasn't supposed to open this because of not the level of classification, but the distribution markings. So I called the ambassador and I said, sir, there's this. He said, open it and read it to me. I said, oh, wait a minute. First of all, I'm not allowed to. He said, I'm your boss. I'm the representative of the president. I represent the commander in chief. Open the goddamn cable. All right. So I opened the, and then he said, read it to me over the phone. I said, but sir, this is not a secure phone.
Line, right.
And he said, it's going to be an instruction to go in and deliver some kind of message to the Yugoslav Foreign Ministry first thing in the morning. So if you read it over the phone, they'll have a chance to work on the translation and they'll be better prepared for what we deliver tomorrow morning. So just read it to me. I said, okay. And so, you know, with great discomfort and trembling, really my hands were shaking, I read this very restricted and highly classified cable to the ambassador over the phone. And he was right. I mean, he knew he'd been in the job for 100 years already. And it was get a meeting at the highest possible level. So he said, all right, now call the ministry duty officer. The next day was Christmas Day, by the way, because this all took place on Christmas Eve. And it looks like we're running out of time. So I'll finish the story next week.
Oh, boy, that is really like a cliffhanger. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
We welcome Arshin Shinit Leah Avuno, who's here on behalf of the Weintraub Israel Center, representing Israel and our community in a wonderful way. And we're going to talk about the Ethiopian Jewish holiday of Sigd, which we celebrate this Tuesday at 6 o'clock at Temple Emmanuel.
Yes.
So last week you told us about how it's celebrated in Ethiopia and now in Israel by going to the highest mountain, asking for forgiveness, dressing in white, making atonement to everybody, and then a party. And at Temple on Tuesday, we're really going to celebrate Ethiopian culture. If people want to dress in white, that's great, but they don't have to fast, and we're just going to go straight to the party.
Yes. So actually in Israel, we celebrated, like, it's became a big festival, which people come, like, not just Ethiopian, everyone. And it's actually a national holiday, so you don't have to go to work or school. And yeah, it's so great.
You don't have to go to work or school Tuesday, guys. I'm just,
yes,
letting you know.
Like, so we celebrate, and like, the Ethiopian culture is really rich. It has a lot of food and dances. And actually in Ethiopia, we have more than 80 different communities, different languages, different dances.
So are we going to do all 80 of those different dances on,
well,
Tuesday
we don't
night?
Have enough time, but we can do one, which is the Beta Israel Amharic, because I'm Amharic. And it's going to be really, really fun. It will have things for the kids to do, for the adults, or
crafts
do,
and games.
Yes, making tachshitim.
Tachshitim. So basically jumpers, like jerseys, like fancy shirts.
Yeah, all
clothing.
Kind of stuff. So it's going to be really, really fun.
And what kind of foods can people expect to hear? I mean, many people don't know Ethiopian food. Maybe they've had injera, maybe not.
So the injera is from the teff flour, and we'll have that. We'll have dabo.
And that's the bread,
which is
the large bread.
Yes.
And you put all kinds,
yes,
of stews and flavors on it.
So you basically eat it with everything.
Right.
And we have another bread, which is like the challah. So in every Jewish Ethiopian house, you'll see the challah and the dabo next to it. It's like a fluffy bread. It's really good. You have to try it.
Okay, I promise.
And the traditional food is with a lot of vegetables and fruits and really healthy food, actually.
Can we expect anything spicy?
Oh, yeah.
Really
be
delicious
ready.
Spice.
Yes, yes, yes. Bring a bottle of water with you, because...
You know what? We'll have water, I promise, from Temple Emmanuel.
Okay,
we'll provide
so
the water if you guys provide the chamin, the spicy stuff.
Okay.
And there'll be sweets and all kinds of flavors.
Yeah, there'll be also like snacks. Like
Ethiopian music, too, I expect. There's some really great
stuff.
Of
course. What do you think, Rabbi? Of course.
Of course.
When it comes to me, it's always music, so
absolutely.
Be prepared.
We'll expect that. It should be a great time. It's 6 o'clock, Temple Emmanuel, 225 North Country Club Road this,
yes,
Tuesday, just a couple days.
Yes.
And
everybody is welcome.
At the wonderful Sigd Festival. It's the first time we've ever celebrated that here in Tucson, Arizona.
I'm happy to be here for the first time.
The first annual.
Oh.
Thanks so much, Leah. We'll talk
Thank
soon.
Thank you.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Jarrow Psychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Geropsych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
We welcome our maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher, head of the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Boker Tov, John.
Boker Tov, good morning.
Good morning and happy end of Thanksgiving weekend.
Yes, another holiday.
Another holiday, which is a kind of a milestone. We remember our lives sometimes based on birthdays. You had
right.
a big one recently.
Yep.
Or seasonal milestones like Thanksgiving or Hanukkah in a month.
Yep, yep.
There's other kinds of milestones, too, though. By educational milestones, we mean something a little different, don't we?
Yeah. You know, developmentally, we're all going through phases. And the truth is that even as adults, we're still going through changes in our lives. But it's so much more apparent and rapid to see a child develop and young people grow from children into adolescence and adulthood.
When kids enter school, the first day of school is a milestone. Even if you're transferring to a new school, it's a kind of a milestone.
Right.
In Judaism, we say shehechianu for every good new thing.
Mm-hmm.
What do you recommend in a Jewish day school or any school? Is there a way to kind of help kids ease into that process?
There are those kind of touch points throughout the year. There's only one first day of school and last day of school, but then you get other moments that are big, that are kind of pinnacle and peak moments in schools. And there's all kinds of things that schools do around those kinds of events. Again, there's a developmental spectrum of what kids experience and do. For example, our first graders, when they finish a section of learning the alphabet, there's a bit of a milestone marker there. There's a point to celebrate. And they do a treasure hunt and they get trophies and we make a big deal about it.
Kind of like a mini Siyum.
We actually have a Siyum for them as well during the year. So first grade celebrates things along those lines. Some schools do a kindergarten promotion at the end of kindergarten. And of course, our system has an eighth grade graduation, which is phenomenal. So celebrating those milestones is a component, but a lot revolves around those moments. So while there may be a day where an event happens, there's a lot that leads up to those things in terms of work and planning, but also psychologically, they're big moments and experiences for our lives.
When kids come to these milestones, there's a certain sense of completion, but we try so hard to tell kids and we try to tell adults that education is an ongoing lifelong process. That's the Jewish concept of it. You don't graduate, you progress
right.
to the next stage. How
right.
do you phrase it? What do you do?
Lifelong learning, one of those important components of our culture. And, as you're growing up, there are certain goals to shoot for, like the milestone, the benchmark of having a bar or bat mitzvah. But what next?
Well,
a few years later,
there's confirmation,
right? And there's always, something, what's the next level? What's the next step? And opportunities. After religious school, THA years, you can go to Hebrew high school. When you graduate from that, there are going to be opportunities in college for involvement and participation.
So it's making learning, making education milestones. But if you keep setting another milestone farther down the road, before you know it,
it helps. Absolutely. And, it's also great to have that culture in the home where you've got books on a shelf where learning is a value.
Absolutely. Thanks, John. We'll talk next week. When we return on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A rabbi, a minister, and a priest played cards every Wednesday night. But they lived in a no-gambling-allowed town, and one day the sheriff raided the game and took them before the judge. After hearing the sheriff's story, the judge asked the priest, "So, were you gambling, Father?" The priest looked to heaven, whispered, "O Lord, forgive me," and replied aloud, "No, Your Honor, I was not gambling." "Were you gambling, Reverend?" the judge then asked the minister. The minister replied, "No, Your Honor, I was not." Turning to the third clergyman, the judge asked, "Were you gambling, Rabbi?" The rabbi eyed him coolly and replied, "With whom?" That was the old Jewish joke of the week. Special feature of Two Jewish just for you. You should live and be well and don't gamble, apparently. And now a word of Torah. Rebecca is pregnant with twins in our portion this week. They are struggling against one another, even in the womb. Like so many, perhaps every pregnant woman, before and after, our mother Rebecca is physically miserable. It gets so bad she cries out, "God, why am I alive?" Roughly the equivalent of, "Just shoot me now." But unlike every other woman in such straits, God actually answers her. God says to Rebecca, "Two nations are in your belly. Two peoples will spread from your womb. One will overcome the other. The elder will serve the younger." It's not clear why this should prove comforting to Rebecca, but she seems to be calmed by these words. And when she gives birth to two healthy boys, the younger is indeed clutching the heel of the elder, seeking from the beginning to supplant him. In our portion of Toldot, so begins yet another tale of sibling rivalry in Genesis, the Ur-text of family dysfunction in human history. The trouble began in the very beginning, just as soon as Adam and Eve were cast from the Garden of Eden. Cain, the first older brother, killed Abel, the first younger brother, had to wander the earth as punishment. Next, Abraham's eldest son Ishmael taunts his younger brother Isaac, and Ishmael and his mother Hagar are thrown out into the wilderness. And now Esau and Jacob have begun to engage in their lifelong wrestling match for their parents' affection. This pattern is repeated again and again in the lives of Jacob's sons in the next generation. Judah, Joseph, and the others all struggling and striving for supremacy against one another, ending with Joseph sold off into slavery in Egypt. In every sibling case like this in Bereishit, at least one of the sons is forced to leave home under severe duress. In every case, too, there's a clear favoritism demonstrated by the parents towards one or the other of the children. It's evident that the familial problems that can exist today are not exactly new phenomena. Sibling rivalry, parental favoritism, and broken homes are rampant in Genesis, which chronicles events that are supposed to have taken place over 3,500 years ago. The more things change, the more they stay the same. Brotherly love is decidedly not the main theme in Toldot, which goes on to describe the distinctly different personalities and pastimes of the two boys, to document Jacob's clever work conning Esau out of his birthright and blessing, his need to flee the scene at the end of the Sedra. But in a larger sense, for all the tsoras caused by competition between brothers in Toldot and throughout Genesis, there's almost always a theme of reconciliation in the end. With the sole exception of Cain and Abel, every one of the mismatched siblings ultimately reconciles. Isaac and Ishmael bury their father Abraham together. Jacob and Esau will later embrace and join together to bury their father Isaac. And even Joseph and his brothers eventually reunite in Egypt while their father is still alive to see it. Over this holiday weekend of Thanksgiving, when we gathered with family members who aren't always so close to us, we remember this theme of reconciliation and reunion. If Jacob and Esau can hug, well, there's hope for all of our own families. In a moment on To Jewish, our guest, Rabbi Jonah Pesner, head of the Religious Action Center, the RAC in Washington, will explore the issue of immigration and how the Reform Movement approaches social justice work. Find out when we come back shortly here on To Jewish.
My name is John Ben Asher, and I'm the head of school at the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Tucson Hebrew Academy is a pluralistic kindergarten through eighth grade Jewish day school. We foster educational excellence through an interdisciplinary, integrated general studies and Judaic curriculum. We teach our students to apply Jewish values and learning to everyday life, enabling them to make their community and the world a better place. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supportive learning environment. From the early years through comprehensive high school prep, children thrive in THA's uniquely enriching educational community and culture. Our 41-year tradition of excellence continues to produce highly skilled, critical, and creative thinking students with a strong moral compass and deep understanding of Jewish identity, traditions, and values, well prepared for the challenges to come. Tucson Hebrew Academy, thaaz.org, 529-3888.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Yeshiva University has named a new president. YU is the premier educational institution of modern Orthodoxy, with 7,000 students in colleges and professional schools, including Cardozo Law School and the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. This week, after a year-long search, Yeshiva University announced its new president is Rabbi Ari Berman, 46 years old, a Queens-bred alumnus of the high school undergrad, Jewish Studies Graduate School, and Rabbinical College of Yeshiva University. Berman takes over an institution struggling to regain its financial footing while being buffeted by shifts in Orthodoxy. Some more liberal voices, including those of Open Orthodoxy, demand a greater role for women. Others from the ultra-Orthodox and Hasidic worlds argue that YU is overly immersed in secular disciplines at the expense of Torah study. Rabbi Berman says he is seeking a transformation, not just a turnaround from the difficulties of recent years, and to increase enrollment and expand its donor base, Yeshiva University, whose motto is the modern Orthodox credo of Torah Umada, Torah along with secular knowledge, will need to reformulate the message and explain the powerful relevance of Yeshiva University today. Because our foundational idea is to integrate the modern world within our Jewish lives, we understand that there's a constant need to reinvent ourselves as the world around us is constantly shifting, said Rabbi Berman. He has been living in a West Bank settlement in the Gush Block in Israel, running the Jewish Heritage Center in Jerusalem, an art and museum and cultural hall, better known as Heichal Shlomo. Previously, Berman was the respected rabbi of the Jewish Center, a prominent modern Orthodox synagogue on the Upper West Side of New York. Berman will be Yeshiva University's fifth president since it was founded in 1915, only five in over a century. In recent years, the school has lost more than $100 million it invested with Bernie Madoff, then had more losses in the 2008 financial crisis. Just 3 years ago, the university, whose annual budget is roughly $225 million, faced a deficit of over $125 million. Its bond rating plummeted, its endowment, once $1.7 billion, shrank to what is now about $650 million. In 2014, Yeshiva agreed to surrender a majority stake in the Einstein Medical School to Montefiore Health System. It had been a financial drain because its government-subsidized research programs required substantial matching outlays. The school also sold off some real estate. Another New York school with Orthodox roots, Touro College, has been running programs aimed at the ultra-Orthodox, scheduling classes that allow men and women to attend on separate days so as not to violate strictures against mixing the sexes. I kid you not. While Yeshiva University has separate colleges for men and women, Yeshiva College in Washington Heights and Stern College for Women in Murray Hill, most of its graduate programs are co-ed. Rabbi Berman will take over July 1st from Richard Joel, president since 2003, who was personally admired but took the blame for the school's financial troubles. In 2015, part of the undergraduate faculty voted no confidence in his leadership. Yeshiva's deficit has now been reduced to $25 million, still large, but much better. Dr. Joshua Joseph, the university's vice president, said that Richard Joel had done some tremendous blocking and tackling to repair the financial condition. Now we're bringing in a new quarterback whose biggest challenge going forward is fundraising. Good luck to Berman, the new head of Yeshiva University. And Ruth Gruber, an American journalist who stumbled into one of the great rescue stories of the Holocaust when the U.S. government appointed her to escort nearly 1,000 Jews across U-boat-infested waters to the U.S., died last week in New York. She was 105 years old. In an era when many female reporters were writing for the social pages, Dr. Gruber, a photographer and reporter, was a dynamic exception. She worked for the New York Herald Tribune. She was the first Western journalist to visit the Soviet Arctic and the Gulag. In 1947, Ruth Gruber watched as a ship carrying 4,000 Holocaust survivors and displaced persons was turned away from British-controlled Palestine. She photographed and later chronicled those events in a book Leon Uris used to write his best-selling novel, Exodus. And when Nazi officials stood trial in Nuremberg, Ruth Gruber was there to report on the events. But it was her transatlantic ship ride with European refugees, a journey she recorded in her 1983 book Haven that became a CBS miniseries starring Natasha Richardson, that remained the defining act of her life. Standing alone on the blacked-out deck, she wrote, "I was trembling with the discovery that from this moment on, my life would be forever bound with rescue and survival." It was 1944, a year before the end of the war. President Franklin D. Roosevelt decided to grant temporary asylum to a group of 36,000 refugees, mostly Jewish, housed in Allied camps in Italy. They would depart from the port of Naples, traverse the ocean by ship, and live until the end of the war at an army camp in Oswego, New York. At the time, the 32-year-old Dr. Gruber was working as a special assistant to Interior Secretary Harold Ickes in a brief interlude to her journalistic career. She recalled the conversation with her boss. "Mr. Secretary, these refugees are going to be terrified, traumatized. Someone needs to fly over and hold their hand." "You're right," Ickes responded. "I'm sending you." Some people considered the assignment too dangerous for a woman. Among them was Dr. Gruber's mother, who came to Washington and confronted Harold Ickes the morning of her daughter's departure, demanding to know how he was going to keep her safe. Ickes said that he was providing Dr. Gruber with papers naming her a simulated general, whatever that is, so that she would be treated as such an officer in accordance with the Geneva Conventions if the ship were intercepted during the trip. That was enough to reassure her worried Jewish mother. Dr. Gruber assumed the only rank on board the ship that commands more respect than general, a mother. The refugees, some of them too old to walk, actually called her Mother Ruth. Fluent in German and Yiddish, she organized English lessons, cared for the seasick, and taught some their first English song, "You Are My Sunshine." Together, they made the journey 2 weeks without attack, and the refugees arrived in the U.S. safe beyond their most roseate dreams. As a condition of their entry into the U.S., they had to sign contracts promising to return to Europe after the war. For many of the refugees, Dr. Ruth Gruber was the only familiar face at their new home. Her job could have been done when they got to the U.S., but she didn't abandon them. She was a leader among the advocates who, after Roosevelt's death, successfully lobbied President Harry Truman to allow them to stay in the U.S. Dr. Gruber remained convinced the U.S. could have saved many more. "I wanted to shake the country by the lapels," she said, "and say, how can we let this go on? How can we let this happen?" Well, as for her own life, the prediction that Dr. Gruber made on the deck of the Henry Gibbons ship turned out to be right. It was all about rescue and survival. The Exodus refugees never faded from her mind. Decades later, she still ran into the occasional person who had been aboard the ship as a child. In her 70s, she was the only foreign correspondent to observe Operation Moses, the airlift of Ethiopian Jews to Israel during a famine and civil war. From a young age, Dr. Gruber defied convention. She graduated from high school at 15 and NYU at 18. She got her master's degree in German literature and went to Germany, and at age 20 earned a doctorate from the University of Cologne. She was the youngest German doctor of philosophy. Living in Germany allowed Dr. Gruber to see the nascent Nazi forces up close. Describing the experience of attending one of their rallies, she wrote that her heart was beating so loudly she feared an SS officer would hear it. She is believed to be survived by less than 100 of the former refugees she helped shepherd to safety. May she rest in peace. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Rabbi Jonah Pesner, is head of the Religious Action Center in Washington, D.C., the arm of the Reform Movement that works for social justice in our nation's capital. He is also a senior vice president, Union for Reform Judaism, position he has held since 2011. He's been the head of the RAC for, since 2015. He's been named one of the most influential rabbis in America by Newsweek magazine. So how did that feel, and how did your parents think of it?
the Newsweek magazine?
Yes.
Well, you know, I'm still here, but Newsweek seems to have stopped publishing, so I don't know how relevant it is. I was proud. I was one of the youngest rabbis to be acknowledged in that way, and so my mother was proud. I think, in this position, you get a lot of press. And I think that the joke in my family was that of all the times I've been quoted in the New York Times and other publications, I got a call when I was running the Boston Marathon, and it was going to fall during Pesach. And so I had to train on matzah. And there's a picture of my wife and me with a Streitz matzah box in our training clothes. And the joke in our family was, who would have ever thought that I'd be the first Pesner to make it into the sports section of the New York Times? So there you go.
Well, that's a much great. Listen, to be able to run on matzah, at least you chose the right brand. Streitz's matzah is definitely the best. An unsolicited testimony. Here in Southern Arizona, immigration has long been a formative and powerful issue. We've seen major efforts towards immigration reform led by our very conservative Senator John McCain. We're about to see a very different approach to immigration nationally, at least based on the rhetoric of the campaign. How does the RAC respond? How do you think Jews should respond? How should people respond?
Yeah, you know, we're very concerned, of course, particularly for all of those dreamers and all of those folks who've been living in the shadows for the last, you know, period of time. You know, I was reading the story of a 29-year-old who came here as a toddler and doesn't know any other country. He's as American as you or I. And works and has studied and now is afraid that because of the change that is likely to come, that he would be deported to a country he's never seen, to speak a language he's never spoken. That's typical, I think, of the millions of dreamers who are out there. I would say my own grandma, Fanny, when she was 16 years old and struggling in the old Russia or some town between Poland and Russia, depending on where the border was, who used to have to hide under the floorboards of the house that my grandfather had built so that she could escape the pogroms and the girls who would be raped by the Cossacks and the boys who would be kidnapped for the Tsar's armies. She got herself to America on a boat at age 16. And so we are, I think, a people of immigrants and a nation of immigrants. And so, you know, though obviously there are concerns about our immigration system, which is broken, and we need to have comprehensive reform, the kind of mean-spirited demonization of the other and the rhetoric that has caused many of our country's problems to be placed on the backs of those who would come to this country to make a better lives for their children, their families, as my grandma Fanny did, is really, you know, quite unsettling and upsetting. And we'll, you know, continue to lift the voice of a fair and compassionate immigration system that helps people come out of the shadows. Frankly, people who are doing jobs that many Americans don't want to do, whether it's cleaning our lawns or washing our toilets or building our infrastructure. These are folks who are working hard and want to be Americans and want to be here. And there is a sensible way to do that.
So in these discussions that are going to be taking place, it seems inevitable, what would be a sensible approach, and how do you expect the RAC to work in the next couple of years?
Well, so much is unknown about what, you know, what the real policies will be that will be forthcoming from this administration and this Congress. We, you know, supported the president's executive orders on DACA and DAPA, and we know that millions and millions of folks have registered through that program, and we'll fight as hard as we can to prevent those orders from being repealed and suddenly putting people who had come forward and register themselves and come out of the shadows and are seeking to be law-abiding Americans or at least law-abiding residents who we thought had a path towards ultimately towards citizenship. Will continue to defend those programs. And then, you know, as Congress begins to look at different forms of legislation, we'll fight hard for the America that we believe is embodied in the Statue of Liberty, where we can have a, you know, a sensible path to citizenship for the folks who are here who are undocumented. Kind of have a common sense approach to immigration reform.
A number of surveys in discussing what motivates younger Jews, millennials, and then the current teen crop to become more Jewish have focused. Most of the surveys have said that the largest motivation is social action or social justice. This may be too easy a question for you, but do you agree with that? Do you think that you can form a Jewish identity revolving primarily around social justice?
No, it's a great question. I think, first of all, social justice isn't some external activity to Jewish life. It is central and core. You know, it's in the word of the prophet, you know, we are called by God to do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly with God.
Why I gave my son the middle name Micah, so just
beautiful. Yeah. Well, you clearly understood, you know, what I think so many of us understand, that Micah was reminding us, which is that to walk humbly with God, to be a religious person, a person of faith, a spiritual person, an observant person, is to do justice and love mercy. So, you know, that said, I think because we live in an era when so many young people grow up with so little Jewish literacy or Jewish competency, social justice becomes a way home for them, because when they experience a Jewish culture that lives its values, that lives its legacy, as Micah said, that has justice at the center, that then opens up a willingness to experience the ritual aspects of Judaism, the observant aspects of Judaism. And so here at the RAC, when we bring our 2,000 teenagers every year to be with us, to learn texts on Jewish social justice and then to go advocate on Capitol Hill, we celebrate Shabbat together. We study sources, both Torah sources, biblical sources, and also rabbinic sources. And we try and work with our educators and chaperones when they're back home in their home congregations and communities to ground all of this work in text and tradition, to study the sources, to advocate and take positions out of our tradition, and then also to make sure to infuse our ritual with work for justice and infuse our work for justice with ritual, whether it's saying of blessings or creating of seders, gathering for Shabbat. This is critical to who we are. So I definitely think it is a way in for young people, but it shouldn't be the only aspect of Jewish life for young people.
What are the, if the RAC had to pick three issues, and I know you have to make these kinds of determinations, what are the three most important issues that you'll be working on, facing, involving congregations, and lobbying for in 2017?
Well, to put that in context, I want to remind your listeners that the Religious Action Center is the site here in Washington where the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was drafted and the Voting Rights Act of 1965 was written. And that's because we played host to the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights. Dr. King, when he would come to Washington, had no offices. He would meet and work in our offices. The leadership of the Civil Rights era used to caucus here. And so we take that legacy very seriously, and we've been working on a racial justice campaign for the last few years where we've really tried to build bridges in communities like Baltimore, Ferguson, New York, Cleveland, across the country to build a stronger fabric across lines of difference, and to work on an element of racial justice in America related to criminal justice reform. It seemed like we were able to bring together Republicans and Democrats in the last Congress. We unfortunately didn't happen. 2.1 million Americans are incarcerated at any one given time, which is more than any other country in the world. They disproportionately impact black Americans. One in three black men go to jail, whereas only one in 17 white men go, and one in six no men go to jail. So we clearly have an incarceration problem in this country, and it is a disproportionately racialized one. And we understand there are lots of conservatives and Republicans who don't believe incarceration is the answer. And we have an election protection problem. You know, the Voting Rights Act, which we helped write, was eviscerated by the Supreme Court case in 2012, Shelby, and really set back voting rights in ways that we are now seeing with a range of voter suppression laws that have been passed in many states. And so we've been working very hard to bring back the Voting Rights Act. Unfortunately, that is not such a winnable strategy in Washington. So we've been working with state and local communities to do a lot of election protection work. We had thousands of our leaders in Ohio and in Georgia and in North Carolina this last election, doing nonpartisan work, just watching the polls, helping people get to the polls, helping make sure they do what is neither a Republican act or a Democratic act, just an American civic act, which is voting.
In involving congregations, the RAC has many different programs, many different ways of connecting particularly young people. What ways can congregations and in what ways can synagogues, but other Jews who may or may not be affiliated, connect to the Religious Action Center best?
We love our congregations. You know, the strength of the Religious Action Center is the nearly 900 congregations in 50 states and Canada. And so we really rely on our congregations to move a justice agenda at a very local level and then to partner with us on a state level and then in Congress. So we have lots of programs starting with the teen years. We have 2,000 teens who come to Washington every year. We bring dozens of college students who are in residence with us during the summer. We work with a range of millennials, recent college graduates, young adults. And then we have training programs for adults, both rabbis who we run through a whole series of trainings, our intensive fellowship that we do for rabbis. We do trainings at rabbinic conferences and other gatherings. And then we do a whole range of trainings for lay leaders so that they can both bring back social justice skills to their congregations and work on either the issues that we share with them and empower them with, or they pick issues that are more germane to their local communities. And we set up communities of practice and active learning networks so that our lay leaders can stay in network with one another and with us, either to work on particular issues or just to share skills. I should, by the way, put in a big plug this April 30th, May 1st and 2nd, will be our consultation on conscience, which is our convention when we bring together hundreds and hundreds of leaders from across the U.S. To come to Washington, hear from dynamic speakers, do some skills training, really experience the power of being here in Washington and advancing our change agenda, and then go home re-energized with their teams to advance the work at a local level. So we bring people here, we go out in the field. That's why I'm coming, and I'm really thrilled to be visiting the community next week and do trainings at a bunch of synagogues across the region.
You know, maybe a final question. I think we're usually very good at talking to people that agree with us. It's often really challenging to talk to people with whom we don't agree politically, or we don't necessarily agree on issues that are issues of conscience for us. How do you recommend people go about doing that in a time of kind of remarkable incivility?
That's maybe the most important question, and I'm glad you're ending with that, because I really do worry about the fabric of American civic society and civility in our country. When I was a grassroots political rabbi at the state level, I worked with Governor Romney. We brought together Republicans and Democrats to do health reform, and it was very respectful. And it was about what common values bind us and what policies could we agree on. And I've noticed a real substantial downturn in the willingness to do that. I think that we lack a curiosity and a genuine interest in the passion and the feelings and the thoughts of other. And I think more dangerously, we lack proximity to one another. People are whether it's through social media or their own neighborhoods, getting kind of trapped in their own bubble. And one of the things I try and do when I travel is really get into conversations in unusual communities that I don't necessarily have opportunity to connect with. I've done a bit of a listening tour in Washington of people whose political ideologies tend not to line up with the historic politics or positions of the Religious Action Center and the Reformed Jewish Movement, and really model from my own position what it is to be interested, curious, open about those with whom I really disagree about matters of public policy. And I would urge all of your listeners to find ways to break out of our bubbles and get into conversation in really thoughtful and respectful ways to understand the views of other. And on a congregational level, by the way, I think it's a core work of every synagogue to find communities in different neighborhoods, different religious traditions, and get into genuine dialogue and get at the pew-to-pew level in people's living rooms and people's kitchen tables, talking about what binds us, but also talking about listening to what separates us.
And that's a great plug, by the way. Also, at Temple Emmanuel on December 5th, we'll be hosting a forum on exactly that, views from the right and the left, just as a community service. I want to thank Rabbi Jonah Pesner for a great visit here on Too Jewish. In addition to hearing you when you're in Arizona, people can go to the RAC. Can you give us the website and people can find out more information about the work of the Religious Action Center?
Oh, I'm thrilled to. So it's just real simple. It's rac.org. That's rac.org. And look for our consultation on conscience, May 1st and 2nd, April 29th, May 1st and 2nd.
Thank you so much. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our guest will be Israeli Major General Doron Almog, winner of the 2016 Israel Prize for his incredible work founding a wonderful institution for mentally challenged and autistic children and adults in Israel. And listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our TooJewishRadio.com website and friend us on Facebook. Our playout this morning on Too Jewish comes as part of our pre-Hanukkah musical preview. It's by my dad, Rabbi and Cantor Baruch Kohan, a setting of the Hanukkah Psalm of Dedication. Pitachta, I've removed my clothes of mourning and clothed myself in joy, performed by Avanim. Remember, the greatest Hanukkah on earth is coming up at Temple Emmanuel, December 11th, 2 weeks from today. My friend, Shavua Tov, have a great morning and completion of your Thanksgiving weekend in a week, we pray, of peace.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.